Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we bring you different aspects of the world of music, including music history. So welcome to This Week in Music History with Follow the Sound and me, Brian Kroc. And along with me is Greg Harvey.
Hello, that's me. I'm Greg.
And filling in for Jacob Crum, DJ Lady Scratch.
Oh, I'm no Jacob Crum.
Hello, that's me. I'm Lady Scratch.
No, that's...
Jake is currently out sick. As you would have probably heard from the episodes last week, I was sick, but I was still getting over a cough and stuff, so I was coughing a lot through the episode. I may cough once or twice in this episode, but I'm feeling a lot better now. But Jake got himself really sick, so he is not here tonight. But Jake would want us to soldier on, so that's exactly what we're doing now.
One like, one prayer.
Yes.
Get better, Jake.
Yes. We're praying for you, buddy.
He's asleep.
Pull through.
Right now. He's unconscious at the moment.
He probably is. Oh, if you want to help out our lovely show and help Jake get better, you can go to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that Amazon banner. It will take you to Amazon, and odds are right now you're doing shopping anyway for Christmas. So go through there, click on that link. It takes you to Amazon. Do all of your normal shopping, and... you know, then we get a little bit of money back from everything that you buy. It's really that simple. So you can go to the website, click on the banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Really, really simple. Please, please do it and help us out. So let's get into This Week in Music History. November 27th through December 1st, we are clearing out the rest of the month and starting a new one tonight. So... let's start off with November 27th. Born on this day in 1942, the one, the only, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, he's a voodoo child.
Jimi Hendrix, of course, well known from coming from the streets of Seattle, going all over the world, making it huge in Britain with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and then coming over to play in America. Starting off at the Monterey Pop Festival, and then inside of 2 years, closing out Woodstock, releasing several albums, including one that we talked about last week, or the week before last, with Electric Ladyland, when he released that album. So many great songs that this man produced. He's considered in the rock format, in the rock genre, but he really kind of expanded that even. And he is still, no matter what, in any conversation about guitar players, he is always in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
He is great.
I can't imagine how inspirational he's been for people like, mm-hmm. I think of like Tom Morello, you know, in forming their own kind of sound based on things that they saw him do with a guitar.
Yep. And it wasn't just the way that he played, too. It was the way that he performed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I remember watching an interview with Crosby from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and all that. And he was talking about the first time that he ever saw Jimi Hendrix, which was at the Monterey Pop Festival. And, like, he puts the guitar down and he lights it on fire. And he said it was such a crazy moment because nobody ever really thought, like, hey, you know, you can do that.
I mean, nobody ever goes.
Instruments were kind of sacred.
It's
like,
yeah.
It's like the Who, of course, got up there and they destroyed everything. It's like, but when Hendrix got up there and destroyed things, it was cool.
It was art.
It was awesome. And I have seen that guitar. I have seen that guitar that he set on fire. It's in a museum in Seattle, and it's kind of an amazing thing to look at
because
you're
really
just like, because there it is. It's
know.
Like the little bits of it burned and stuff like that. Somebody put it out.
To be in its presence would be amazing.
Can you imagine?
Yes.
You can still feel the heat radiating.
And that was his first performance in America, correct?
Pretty much. Yeah. It was the one that really introduced him to America.
Can you imagine?
So, because it was him playing in front of like all of these other really influential artists.
Right.
I mean, the entire thing was put on by the Mamas and the Papas. And, you know, they had already broken up actually at the time. But yeah, it was really funny because the story goes that they had invited Paul McCartney to come and play, like basically like with the Beatles. And they had just like sworn off like touring at that point because they just couldn't do it.
I remember
because
that,
of all
that
the screaming.
Time frame. Yeah.
Yeah.
They had
and
to take
so
break.
So Paul contacted them back and said, hey, we can't come, but you guys should get this guy Jimi Hendrix to come. It's like, wow, he's really cool.
I didn't know that was all in the same time frame. We literally just watched a documentary on the Beatles on PBS the other night, and I was talking about that part that I was watching the most actively was about where they had to stop touring, and I didn't realize all of that.
Yeah, it kind of all played together. And because they stopped touring, he then basically got Jimi Hendrix and The Who to go play at the Monterey Pop Festival. And they already knew each other.
Right.
It's like, but nobody else really in America knew who these dudes were.
And their first experience with them is those
performances. And, like,
performances.
Their first major experience is at the Monterey Pop Festival. And there was a big argument on who was going to go on first, whether it be The Who or Jimi Hendrix. And Pete Townsend said that Hendrix got this look in his face, like this angry look. And he stood on top of his amp and played at him. He goes, he wasn't just playing. He was playing at me, like, you know, you little piece of crap. How dare you try to challenge? Like, that's what, like, Pete Townsend basically said. He's like, Hendrix just stood up, asserted his dominance, and then Pete Townsend was just like, fine. And then Hendrix was like, fine, I'll play second. Because he knew that The Who wanted to get out there and destroy their stuff first, because they knew that that was going to be a shocking thing.
That's their shtick, and he knew it.
And then that's when Townsend jokingly said that, you know, when he destroys a guitar, it's like this weird, violent rape, basically. He goes, when Hendrix destroys a guitar, it's like this sensual sacrifice.
Yes. Yeah, it is more of, I was going to say, it's more of a sacrifice than anything else.
Jimmy does it way sexier.
Yes,
oh, Jimmy.
So that's kind of the point. Jimi Hendrix, of course, one of the greatest guitar players listed in rock history, and sadly taken way too young.
27 Club, yes?
27 Club.
Shame.
And just taken way too soon.
He was murdered in a conspiracy.
So, Jimi Hendrix, we wish you a happy birthday wherever you are, and we hope that you're at least doing okay. And if you're not doing okay, we will at least remember you for a very, very long time.
That's true. I don't know how you could do worse than dead. Oh, jeez.
All right.
Well, if you believe in an afterlife.
1964 is the year Mick Jagger is the man. He was fined £16 for driving offenses by a court in Tettenhall, Steffes. His solicitor told the court, "The Duke of Marlborough had longer hair than my client, and he won some famous battles. His hair was powdered, I think because of fleas. My client has no fleas."
I thought that was hilarious that they went to court for like a £16 fine. It's like,
my client has no fleas.
It's like, and what's your defense? My client has no fleas.
And then he turns and looks at the camera and it's just like, frontline.
He had shorter hair than the Duke of Marlborough. Because that
commercial
makes sense.
We treat Mick every month. There's no way he has fleas.
Yeah, Mick already has his collar on. Clearly you can see it.
He gets a shot of penicillin every 14 days. There's no way he's infected with anything.
Wow.
Would you like to keep your Mick Jagger protected from fleas and ticks? Try Frontline.
Itching, irritated Mick Jaggers.
Apply Frontline to the back of the neck, between the shoulder blades.
Oh, make sure your dog's hair isn't powdered.
Anybody who's had a dog knows that joke right there. It's like, who uses Frontline? I hate putting Frontline on my dogs because I've got two fluffy dogs, and it's just near impossible to get them.
I like it because I know they're being protected, and it makes me feel like a good owner because I gave them something.
That is true. All right, let's go ahead and move on to 1970.
Yes. You love this one.
This is a good one because I'm a big fan. And actually, I will preface this. We have a few Beatles ones to do this week, and that's because they were just really, really good. So, starting off, November 27th, 1970, George Harrison released All Things Must Pass, which includes the hit singles My Sweet Lord, What Is Life, as well as songs Isn't It a Pity, and the title track that had been turned down for inclusion on releases by the Beatles, but the triple album, it was a triple album, not a double album, triple album.
That means three.
Would go on to be certified 6 times platinum by the RIAA, making it the best-selling album of a solo Beatle.
Take that, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of amazing. So,
feeling lost?
Hare Krishna.
Have you tried Hare Krishna?
It's a running gag. Okay.
I mean, My Sweet Lord has always been a great song.
It's beautiful.
It is a very beautiful song.
It gives me feelings.
Yeah. Now, here's the other thing, too. I mean, I'm just going to segue this. If you have not seen the concert for George, you are missing out on one of the best concerts ever recorded.
Where could you view that concert?
You can get it on DVD.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
Can you buy it on Amazon.com?
I'm sure you can buy it on Amazon.com.
Well, if you go to Amazon, can you help follow the sound?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Thank you, Miss Lady Scratch.
Get the DVD through our website.
So, the reason why it is one of the best things that I have ever seen is that it really like is a great celebration of his life. They do... The very first part is actually a composition by Ravi Shankar and his daughter involving an Indian orchestra. And then it sort of slowly transitions into this other thing where like for a bit they're playing a song and Eric Clapton comes out and actually plays along with them.
Wow.
And it's just gorgeous. It's one of the best like little musical parts that I've ever heard. And then they kind of transition to some of the other stuff. They have a bit of a comedy routine done by Monty Python because he was really close with the Monty Python crew. I think he funded like one of their movies basically, like to get it done. Like, I mean, he was really, really involved in their stuff.
I love George Harrison.
And so they got that. And then they bring out like the rest of the members of the Traveling Wilburys, I think except for Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And so like they get some of those guys to play, they get other people to come in and do like some songs. Then Paul McCartney comes out and starts playing the ukulele. He said, and he's like, you know, anytime we had a party over with George or at his house or something, eventually the ukuleles would come out. He goes, and we'd start playing a song, and then he starts doing, you know, Something in the Way She Moves. And like, it's absolutely a great, great celebration of that man's life. It is one of the best concerts I've ever seen on like recorded film.
It sounds like something I should wrap myself in a blanket with, grab a pint of ice cream, and weep at the house of George Harrison.
Yeah. And like, it's really, really good. But the Indian music is very well done. And then, like I said, that moment where Clapton walks out and starts playing with them, it brought me to tears the first time I saw it. That was amazing.
Fantastic that Ravi Shankar was involved in it and all that Indian orchestra, because that was a very significant phase for George Harrison, and he didn't pass until the aughts, right?
Yeah. So, and his daughter was actually the one conducting, but it was Ravi who composed it. So
that's wonderful.
And
way to honor him.
Yeah. So, but they had a bunch of different guest musicians show up, like Billy Preston came in and did a song.
Wow.
And then they had Danny Harrison get up there and play.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never seen Danny, he looks exactly like his father. It's kind of ridiculous, which is why I have always said that the kids of the Beatles need to get together, because they're all musicians, too. And they need to create their own band.
The Beatlets.
There was a joke going around that they actually were going to do that, but then they nothing ever came of it. So.
The Beatlets.
The Beatlets.
No.
they were going to call themselves, like, I think they said that they were going to call themselves like Derived or something like that, because they were the derivatives of the Beatles.
That's too deep.
And I was like, okay, whatever. But
the Chosen.
Let's go ahead and move on.
Well, still staying British, at least. The year 1981, the British phonographic industry placed advertisements in the press claiming that home taping was wiping out music. The Boomtown Rats, 10cc, Elton John, and Cliff Richard all backed the campaign. So home taping, they thought, was going to be the downfall of music. Isn't that like where we find new music these days?
See, that's one of the reasons why I actually put this note in here, because it's like the same conversation
we're still having,
except it's with whatever the new format happens to be.
Well, yeah, because now it's like YouTube.
You could change it from the British phonographic industry to Lars Ulrich and change home taping to illegal pirating, and this would be the same conversation.
Yeah. Well, it's just, yeah, the people who have already found success in the industry are then trying to prevent people with limited access and funds to come up and get in their position. It's weird. It seems like kind of a double standard,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, because, you know, you want to be supportive of new music, but yet, you know, like Pete Townsend always reminds me of a good example, that Pete always wanted to be famous and never wanted anybody else to be famous. And, or at least that's the, you know, the persona he always put off to me, because mm-hmm. he'd have interviews and stuff where he'd be like, you know, so-and-so was a good guitarist, but they weren't, you know, better than me.
Well, I'm not surprised that Elton John was behind this, too, because Elton's a bit of the same way. He's quite the diva from what I've read. I mean, he's very serious about, don't you know who I am? I'm Elton John. And recently read an article where he was complaining that people were being ageist by not getting his most recent album, but that's another story.
Hmm.
But it doesn't surprise me that he was part of the press campaign about home taping wiping out music, because he's very serious about artists getting paid for their work.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because I'm thinking home taping, like home recordings, but this is
this is like recording off the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is like that minute that you sit there with your finger on both buttons on the cassette thing and you wait for the DJ to stop speaking so you can catch the intro of the song, you know?
Yeah, I think that's how I ended up with my first Rob Zombie recording, was that I pressed record during like a segue and just, you know, to catch a full song. And it's uh-huh. like the next one that came on was Living Dead Girl. And I think that's the first time I ever had Living Dead Girl on tape was when I was like 8.
Gosh,
and I recorded it on the radio.
I don't remember the first song I ever home taped. I think the first song I ever downloaded off of Napster was Carry On Wayward Son.
Yeah. It wasn't free?
No, it was Carry On Wayward Son.
That's fun.
I was like 14. Speaking of being young, okay. So in 2005, multimillionaire defense contractor David H. Brooks booked New York's Rainbow Room and his daughter Elizabeth's favorite acts for her bat mitzvah coming-of-age celebration. The stars who appeared included 50 Cent, Tom Petty, Aerosmith, Don Henley, Joe Walsh, and Stevie Nicks.
Wow.
50 Cent was paid $500,000 to appear and performed only 4 songs, but he did manage to work in the lyric, "Go shawty, it's your bat mitzvah, we gonna party like it's your bat mitzvah." The party costs an estimated... No, we are not. It is her bat mitzvah. You just settle down there, Greg.
Your bat mitzvah.
The party costs an estimated $10 million, including the price of corporate jets to get the performers to and from the venue. I remember when this happened. This was like during the big My Super Sweet 16 boom that MTV had going in the early aughts. And so it was a lot of big competition with you know, quinceañeras and Sweet 16s and bat mitzvahs, like who could have the biggest, most extravagant, elaborate party. And when this girl... I remember seeing an interview with her, and she was like, "My dad said I could do whatever I wanted for my bat mitzvah." Like, it was just very of that time. If you watch the interview with her and her dad, but I was surprised to see that. How old are you during usually a bat mitzvah? It's like 13, 14, right?
Yeah, 13.
It's 13.
Yeah, by Jewish law, you become an adult at 13.
Okay, I thought it was 13 or 14. That
it's 13.
Makes sense. But
yep.
I was surprised to see that a 13-year-old chose Don Henley, Joe Walsh, and Stevie Nicks. I'm wondering how much pull she actually had.
Well, somebody was connected.
Now, here's the deal. My wife was super into, like, those types of groups when she was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I mean, she was weirdly obsessed with Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac. So
was?
Well, she still is, but she was more obsessed back then. So, you know... It kind of cracks me up that, like, it's possible
that she
was super into it.
The first cassette tape I bought for my car when I turned 16 was Aerosmith's Greatest Hits. Not Big Ones, but Greatest Hits. The one that started with Dream On.
Yeah.
So I get it.
But considering this happened in 2005.
But in 05.
I mean, like, odds are, I mean, she or he wouldn't... it says girl. Yeah. Well, but that's the funny. It said his daughter Elizabeth's favorite acts. So that's why.
If she likes Tom Petty, Aerosmith, Don Henley, Joe Walsh, and Stevie Nicks, then he's doing right. Good job, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there is that.
That being said, if my daughter turned 13, I didn't spend near $10 million on her birthday. Sorry, baby.
Well, she didn't have a bat mitzvah.
Of age yet. I'm pushing that off as long as I can.
All right. So I just wanted to close this out by also saying that the proposed name of the Beatles kids band would be called The Shoots, as in the offshoots.
Well, that's kind of cute.
But apparently Zach Starkey has put the kibosh on this, and he was just like, why would I want to do that?
That's fair.
Like, Wait a second. This is dumb.
It's like I'm out rocking like with The Who and Oasis. It's like I don't need to like do this other thing.
I'm
so
good.
But it would be, see, but that's the thing. Like, I don't really care if Zach Starkey was in the band. I was like, but if you got like Danny, Julian, and, well, I forgot what Paul's kid's name is. But I think it's Michael or something. Oh, James. That's what it is. Yeah. So if you got like those three together, I'd still be perfectly happy with that. So
I'm going to take your word for it. Whichever one is good at playing their instruments.
That's honestly,
usually
though,
the best ones
honestly,
to start a band.
Out of the groups, out of those musicians right there, Julian is my favorite.
Yeah.
Because Julian's solo album is amazing.
Like, he's proved himself already.
Yeah. It is honestly one of the greatest, like, artistic albums I've ever heard in my life. And what was really cool is that he released, like, a DVD with it of, like, the music videos, and they all kind of tie together.
Neat.
And it's like, even though there's like weird dream sequences and stuff like that, just really, really well done.
Into the Julian universe.
Yeah. Like trapped in the closet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys, I think it's time for a brand new day.
November 28th. Born on this day, Berry Gordy.
Thank goodness.
Now, yay! Most of you will probably know who Berry Gordy is. But for those of you who don't know, Berry Gordy was the founder of Motown Records, which launched numerous careers and created one of the greatest session bands ever created on earth with the Funk Brothers. I mean, but like, if you just look up anybody, any of the groups that came out of Motown, like, each one of them had huge success.
Mm-hmm.
And just like are still either out there touring today, you know, or doing something if they're still alive. It's like, that just, it launched so many careers and made so much money for some of these people. It's just kind of astounding.
I made an executive decision that I don't have the power to make at the restaurant that I work at. And we do Motown Mondays.
Yes.
So like the only music that we have on Mondays is Motown. You can't imagine how many people come in on a Monday, you know, first thing in the morning, getting ready to start their day, or like it's Monday and it's lunchtime, and they come in and they hear Motown, and they immediately are just at so much more peace. It's just like, oh, this is a good song. I remember mm-hmm. this song. It just makes everybody happy, or at least have a feeling different than what you were just feeling. It hits you so quickly. So many people can relate to Motown, and it started so many amazing different other offshoots of music.
Yes. So, Berry Gordy creates Motown, does really good stuff, makes a ton of money, and blah, 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 blah. Then basically shuts down Motown, moves off to L.A., and starts making movies where he makes the greatest Kung Fu movie of all time.
Ooh.
The Last Dragon.
Kung Fu Panda.
The Last Dragon. Released in 1985. Is the story of Bruce Leroy.
Wait, really? That's yes. The name of the movie?
Yes. Going up against Shonuff, the Shogun of Harlem.
Like, I knew that part. I didn't realize his name
what's
in the movie
my
was
name?
Bruce Leroy.
Shonuff! What's my name? Shonuff!
Bruce Leroy.
The Shogun of Harlem.
Bruce Leroy.
Bruce Leroy.
I'm tickled.
Which, of course, makes me think that's what spawned the whole Leroy Jenkins thing. But, you know,
I still don't know where the hell that came from.
Leroy Jenkins,
yeah.
World of Warcraft. Leroy Jenkins.
That's why I have no idea where it
I'd
came
like
from.
To point out that IMDb actually says that his name is Leroy Green, but everybody in there keeps calling him, like, they call him Leroy, but for some reason, like, they keep calling him Bruce Leroy throughout the movie.
I get it. I get where they got that.
But,
hey.
Yeah.
Well, folks.
Weirdly enough, in that movie, too, bad guy, besides Shonuff, the Shogun of Harlem, the other bad guy, is Armenian, which is totally out of character.
Does he have a completely...
Because the bad guy's name is Eddie Arcadian.
Oh, that's not as exciting as Shonuff.
Eddie Armenian! Ah.
And here's the thing, it says right there, Shonuff, the Shogun of Harlem. That's what it says right there for the name and the title.
Shonuff it does.
Played by the great Julius Carey, who, if you have not actually seen in any of the other stuff, that dude is a great actor. Really, really good actor. I loved watching him in a bunch of stuff.
Well, this next thing...
Go ahead, move on.
Yeah,
fine.
This next thing is a very momentous occasion in music history, but yet overshadowed by that previous fact of Bruce Leroy. 1960, Elvis Presley started a six-week run at number one on the U.S. Singles Chart with Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Are you lonesome tonight?
This was his third U.S. number one of the year, 1960.
Of the year.
Yeah.
Do you subscribe to the notion that people are either Elvis fans or Beatles fans?
Yes.
I do too.
Which is really funny because the first time I ever asked that to somebody, I was like, are you Beatles people or Elvis people? And she goes, I'm a Monkees person. And I was like,
you win.
Oops.
All right.
You win.
All right. I get it.
Oopsie doodle. I don't think you heard the question there.
I'm a Monkees
Basically,
person.
What I boiled it down to is, are you the type of person who likes a band or are you a person who likes an artist?
That's not why I like the Beatles over Elvis.
See, but that's kind of that argument to me is still being waged today, because you get people who like the individual artist more than they like a band.
Oh, that's definitely true.
That's why we get like Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift and like, you know, that kind of stuff, because those pop artists are the individual artist. It's like, but the bands, the ones who usually have to create their own music and like do that kind of stuff, they're harder to get into, but there's like a little bit of a disconnect from them. So it's like,
I suppose it's if you're the kind of person that wants to relate directly to the person in front of you, or if you're the kind of person that is enjoying seeing the forest for the forest.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
I get it.
Okay.
I just said, like, for me though, it's always sort of been this argument of, you know, do you like the artist who generally speaking is given their music, or do you like the band that they create their music?
I just don't like Elvis.
See, I do like Elvis though. But I have always liked the Beatles more because I always thought that their music was more complex.
Mm-hmm. I can certainly appreciate Elvis' contributions.
And I even prefer like the earlier 60s Beatles than I do later Beatles. Just because they had like more harmony parts. They had like just really good rock and roll stuff. You know, it's like when they started getting more into like the drug stuff, that's when I kind of have a disconnect from the Beatles.
Which is fair. A lot of people do that as well. And I don't think we have a similar... I mean, we've got a similar point in Elvis's career as well, where it was just like, he's starting to fall off, you know?
Yeah.
And that's that whole artist versus band thing too, because if you're an individual artist type follower, once that artist falls off, you have nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's just gone. And with the Beatles, you know, even if they collectively go somewhere, you still have that relation. Like, okay, the band is going somewhere. Let's go with the band.
Yes, yes.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, totally.
I'm glad you're relaying what I'm trying to get out of my brain.
I got it. Like, you and I, we're on the same wavelength here. So, but speaking of same wavelength, please go on to the next one.
Speaking of same wavelength, Dirty Dancing, the song from the film. Everybody knows, I've had the time of my life.
What's number one again?
In 1987,
right,
on November 28th. Went to number one on the U.S. singles chart. In the U.K., the song had two chart outings in November 87 and after the film started being shown on TV in January 91. So it was good. It was big on the charts after the movie was released in theaters.
And then it was big again when
they
started
playing it. Then it got syndicated and everybody was like, oh, I love this movie. And the song went back on the charts, which I think is really cool because it's not often that you see a song leave the charts for such a significant amount of time and make a comeback. I can think of only a handful of songs that have done that. Bohemian Rhapsody, Comes and Goes.
Yeah. Bohemian Rhapsody like didn't really
when
make
Wayne's
a
World
huge
came
splash,
out, it
and then
came
Wayne's
out
World
again.
It became huge again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I got this theory that in the next when the Freddie Mercury biopic comes out, like there's going to be another resurgence of Queen music making it big. So I got that feeling. So, man, I was going to transition to something, but I completely forgot what it was. Oh, now I remember. So this movie, of course, has been quite popular as far as like being a cult classic now.
Sure.
There was one sequel, which was really stupid, the Havana Nights
or whatever it was. We don't even need to talk about that.
Which is really horrendous. But then it got turned into a Broadway musical.
I've seen the previews for that, and it looks really good.
So here's the funny thing about it.
Oh, no.
No. It's actually really good.
Oh, good.
So recently, last year, the Dirty Dancing came on tour, you know, and they came to St. Louis, which is where we are. Little did I know that the saxophone player who plays in that band is none other than Brian Croc.
Get out of town.
Yep.
So he gets to play the big sax solo in Time of My Life, and you're like, that's my guy.
That's my guy.
That's him.
So, yeah, Brian Croc has become my de facto best friend. I'm kidding. No. he's become a very good friend, I think, in this last year. Just from the few times that we've gotten to hang out, it's like a weird synchronicity that we have.
If there's another lady scratch in the world, can I meet you?
So, but yeah, I found out that he was coming to town to play for that show. And so we ended up meeting and doing all that stuff.
What an awesome spot to get to play. If you want to be a professional saxophonist.
So
he's crazy. Crocs combined.
He's crazy good. Like he posted a video today that I saw and he's playing guitar and stuff. And I was just like, he's kind of playing it like a harp really. Like he's plucking individual strings and stuff, but it's just like, I don't know, man, that dude is just way, way more talented than me. So. But I think I've got the better radio voice, so, I mean, it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next thing, which happens, of course, in 1987. REM had their first entry in the top 10 on the U.S. singles chart with The One I Love.
Fire!
This one goes out to the one I love.
That song is so 90s, and it just brings back all of those 90s feelings.
Which is funny because it was released in 87.
I know, but it's so 90s, is it not?
Yeah, that's true. That is very true.
It sounds like it could have been on the soundtrack to Friends.
So here's kind of the funny thing about this, is that, and every time I bring up REM, I've got to bring this up. So the lead singer, Mr. Michael Stipe, right?
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Collinsville, Illinois. For a while.
I remember this story.
Went to Collinsville High School and worked at the Collinsville Waffle House, which that building has since been torn down, and another Waffle House was built in its place.
Yeah.
A newer, better Waffle House.
That's actually my favorite Waffle House.
Didn't leave it as a tribute to Michael Stipe?
No. But even
there's
worse
a plaque
than that,
in the bathroom.
I was going to say, does he have a booth?
Because I didn't think there
does
was.
Does he have a Stipe booth like Kenny Rogers has?
It's
in
like a
places?
It's like a napkin.
So. But here's kind of the crazy thing. Everybody knows this. Everybody in Collinsville knows this. And Michael Stipe is kind of like, I wouldn't say he's disowned Collinsville, but he was definitely like, it was not a fun experience. But everybody in Collinsville was like, hey, you know, lead singer REM, he lived in Collinsville for a while. He's great, you know. But they not only do they not really say anything about him like at the Waffle House. You know, every Waffle House has a jukebox.
Mm-hmm.
There are no REM songs in that jukebox.
Oh, snap. Well, it's too recent of a band for Waffle House jukebox, though.
Rude.
Waffle House jukebox is all like Elvis Presley and stuff.
It's just a thing. Like, it should just be done.
At that Waffle House.
Yeah, at that Waffle House, it makes sense.
You ever been to, like, a Texas Roadhouse, and there's, like, a whole corner devoted to Willie Nelson?
Exactly.
They got Willie's corner. They don't have Michael's corner.
Well, maybe the local...
Mikey's corner.
Maybe the local Applebee's can do something for him, because that's something they do.
That's down the street, so...
I didn't work at Applebee's.
I used to go to Applebee's every like Wednesday night, though. So,
you know, who like, I bet didn't go.
Whatever
to Applebee's.
It was, they had half price appetizers. That's what
Michael
I used to
Stipe.
Go.
No, I was gonna say
Michael Stipe boycotted the chicken strips.
Either way, good on REM for making it big. They've always been a band that I've respected.
I've never considered them an '80s band ever, even though
despite the fact that they made their first initial hits,
they
in the
are
80s.
My '90s heart.
It's kind of weird, don't you think? Because they had that sound like before the 90s grunge era.
Yeah, they did. And then the Shiny Happy People, when they did that song, and it was just so huge, and it kind of like gave us this new wake of like, let's do some happy pop. Are we still mad? Are we still angsty? Let's
Well, and a rock band with a mandolin.
That's true.
That
and
like,
these strings.
I don't think it ever really occurred to me, you know, that was in there until...
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's good stuff. It's just, it's always fun when you have a band that like has other instruments that are kind of out there.
I like that.
I love REM. You know who else I loved?
Who?
Whitney Houston.
Do you?
Yeah, in 92, that was this day, November 28th, in 92 is when she hit number one on the singles chart with I Will Always Love You from the Bodyguard soundtrack.
Yes.
Originally recorded by the one and only Miss Dolly Parton.
Yeah, we are big fans of Dolly on this show.
14 weeks that woman was at number one with that song. I remember that. When she was a number one on the charts with I Will Always Love You. I remember seeing her on one of the morning shows, like a Morning America or something, and she was performing, and I didn't know until years later that it was originally a Dolly song until I saw Dolly perform it.
Yeah.
Because she was saying, you know, she killed it.
Dolly originally wrote it as kind of like her farewell to Porter Wagoner because she was leaving the show.
Wow.
And so she wrote it and she took it to him and said, you know, hey, do you want to do this song? Blah, blah, blah. And he goes, no, it's like, you have to do this song. Like, this is your song.
Just one
please
song.
Perform it. Just yeah. do it solo. It's like, and then we'll send you off, you know, to go off and pursue whatever it is you want to pursue. And so she did that. She performed the song, and then she was like gone off the show and stuff. And then she went off to do like all the big stuff that she would go on and do.
Started Dollywood and all that business.
But when Whitney did it and Dolly heard it for the first time, she called her up and said, "That song is yours now."
I love that
story. Like, she's like.
I love
she
Dolly
could do
Parton.
It still, like, but yeah, Dolly just like she knew it's like when somebody did something really special. So yeah.
And Dolly's not afraid. She's the kind of person that's not afraid to give credit where credit is due and just be like, oh no, that I did the song first, but that's her song. That's,
yeah,
you know, no, I may have done
it
first.
She was really supportive of when Miley Cyrus did Jolene.
Oh my gosh,
and
yes.
Like that. But of course, that's a little bit different because Dolly Parton, I believe, is actually her godmother.
Mm-hmm.
So there, yeah, I mean that's. There is a familial connection, at least for that one.
Well, she came out and did when Jack White did a cover of Jolene too. She was just like, "I've never heard it that way. Good job." You know, like she just
yeah, yeah.
Anytime somebody
I've
covers one of her
that.
Songs, she's always so cordial and just kind about it.
Yeah,
and gracious that people
yes.
would record her music. It's wonderful. I absolutely love her.
But back to Whitney.
Sorry, back to Whitney.
Whitney honestly had one of the most powerful voices I think that I'd ever heard at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, and mind you, my exposure to like power vocalists was pretty much limited to only men at that time. And so it's like when I heard her do that song and do a bunch of the other ones that she did where she just like nails all those notes and like just coming out of this really like skinny frame of a woman.
Yeah.
It's like, it was like, oh my goodness. Like I didn't think this was like really that possible. And now she honestly has become the standard by which other power vocalists mm-hmm. try to achieve.
Mm-hmm. I remember being in my room as a kid, and I was a big Mariah Carey fan at the time, too, mm-hmm. because she was a power vocalist. And I thought I could also be a power vocalist at lesser than the age of 10. What was this? and so I would have Barbie battles in my room, and this Barbie's Whitney Houston and this Barbie's Mariah Carey. And we would have power vocal offs, and my mother would be like, "Brianna Dawn, if you don't shut up. I love you and you're a beautiful singer, but you can't do what they can do, dear."
Oh, man. Yeah.
Anyway, I played with Barbie.
Wow.
But Whitney was amazing. Sorry.
Yes.
Was amazing. And she could blow the roof off of a place. But yes, she did. That was a fantastic thing. Anything sticking on the charts for 14 weeks is obviously, I mean, at least at number one for 14 weeks. That's an impressive feat. So.
And to be something that still years later, I mean, that was 92 and this is 2017 and people
exactly.
are still like, "What's the greatest love song of all time?" You know, a lot of people put that right at the top of the list.
"My Heart Will Go On" by Celine Dion.
Well,
my dad can play that on Penny Whistle, and it always cracks me up.
Speaking of our hearts going on.
I was
going
to say, speaking of things being sticky.
Oh, God. You had to go there.
In the year 2006.
In the year 2000.
Actress Pamela Anderson filed for divorce from rapper and rocker Kid Rock after just 4 months of marriage.
I think we're using the word rapper a little loosely here.
In a statement on her website, the 39-year-old confirmed that she had split from the kid known as Rock.
Was it due to his conservative views?
He's so gross.
You want to know something funny? My wife, you know, works for Live Nation, has had interactions with plenty of rockers and musicians and stuff like that. She actually said that Kid Rock was one of the nicest people. And like when she was on like a conference call with him, like he was super cool and polite to everybody. And like talked about how he wanted everything in his merch table sold for under like 20 or under because, you know, he doesn't want to gouge his fans.
Well, he knows his fans. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like this is
that's not even a dig. It could
it's
be,
not
but it's
dig.
Not.
It's
like it's one of those things where, you know, it's like you can absolutely despise him. But fact of the matter is, He's a pretty decent human being.
Well, and I'm saying I grossed out by Kid Rock,
yeah,
who I'm sure is not anything like
yeah.
whatever his civilian name is.
He also wished that he hadn't chosen the name Kid Rock.
I bet he's, yeah.
I worked really well for when he was in his prime.
Yeah.
Like, that was a great,
when
like,
he
I thought it was
it
a great.
During Ba with the Ba, it sounded
yeah,
great.
Now yeah. he's like, but now I'm like 40-something. It's like, and it's a little weird to be called Kid, so.
Yeah, well.
And he can't just shorten it. He can't just be called Rock.
There's already one of those. We already have The Rock.
And he's in his 40s, too.
And
so.
He'll kick your
I
ass.
Honestly think that Kid Rock is a fine name, and you should just deal with it. Just own it.
Just shut up, Kid Rock.
Just be quiet, Kid Rock.
You
just
ruined Warren Zevon for me.
Well, oh, man.
No, I'm just kidding.
Not this again.
It's funny because I was legitimately hoping that he was going to, like, run for whatever that political office was.
Oh, my gosh.
In Michigan. I was so hoping.
Kid Rock, Ted
like,
Nugent,
dude,
2020.
Dude.
Oh, gosh.
It's like, this would be just one of the greatest campaigns.
White trash dystopia.
Of all time.
But they're going to settle.
It'd be amazing.
The election will be settled through a backyard wrestling match.
And then we'll all go deer hunting.
All right, let's go ahead and move on to November 29th. I got a trio of Beatles history facts.
Here's some
for you.
Beatles mania.
So I looked at November 29th, and there was nothing else that I really found that I was like, yeah, I want to put that in this list. But I did find three Beatles facts that I thought were interesting. So here we go without further ado. 1963 on November 29th. I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles was released in the UK. For the first time ever in the UK, advanced orders passed the 1 million mark. They sold a million albums before the song even came out.
That's really impressive, because how many singles did they have before that?
Several.
Did they?
As far as I understand, yeah, they had a few before then. And so it was like, just the fact that it was the first time that they'd had a million in pre-sales.
That's
pretty awesome.
Well, even, I mean, for me, just thinking.
And well, it's less than a million in the UK to make platinum status. So it made platinum status before that.
Well, I think it's amazing, too, is that the concept of, hey, did you hear there's a new Beatles song coming out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll buy that. That's all people needed.
Yeah.
You know, in pre-sales.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's pretty good.
New Beatles song coming out. I will buy that.
Okay.
So there you go.
Take
Not to mention,
money.
I Want to Hold Your Hand is one of my favorite songs that they did.
That's the Beatles one that song. I've been learning on the guitar.
Yeah.
I know.
That's really
and
cool.
When I touch you, I feel happy inside. Yeah. Oh, that goes on. That's the list of the songs where people mess up the lyrics, too.
Oh, yeah?
Where they say, you know, we've talked about this before. They say, I can't hide. I can't hide. I get high.
Oh. They definitely did not say I get high.
Yeah,
so.
but it's what it sounds like. Whoa. So.
Yes. All right, moving on up to 1980. John and Yoko's Double Fantasy album was released. Though initially poorly received, the album is notable for its association with Lennon's murder less than 3 weeks after its release, whereupon it became a worldwide commercial success and went on to win the 1981 Album of the Year at the 24th Annual Grammy Awards.
Wow.
So it almost makes me wonder, though, like, if he hadn't died, like, would that album have just sort of faded into, like, you know, obscurity? Not obscurity, because it's still a Yoko yeah. or a John Lennon album.
I don't think we would have paid as yeah. much attention to it.
And I don't think it would have won, Album of the Year at the Grammys.
No.
And I'm glad you said that, too, because I thought it, but I didn't want to, like, say that and be a jerk.
Yes.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because it is. It's like, how much of that was propelled by his death?
Yes.
Yeah, it's certainly, it's an art piece. It's a performance art piece for me more
yes.
than it's a musical album.
Absolutely.
So
totally agree.
That being said.
So here's my weird story, and I believe I've said this before on the show. I picked up this album at a local record store here in St. Louis known as Vintage Vinyl. Anybody in St. Louis knows about Vintage Vinyl because they're like the record store that everybody goes to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been numerous celebrities that go there. Bands play small shows there. I saw Mumford & Sons there. Like, they played there before, you know, going and playing at the Scott Trade Center.
Wow.
Like, that night. Like, and it was amazing. Like, I was literally like 10 feet from them, and like they played like four or five songs or something. It was crazy. So vintage vinyl is like the cool place to go to get albums and stuff. And it's still a popular destination point. So I pick up Double Fantasy, and I picked up Phil Collins Face Value. And I go up to the guy, and I'm like, hey, it's like, I'm going to get these two albums. And the guy looks at Double Fantasy. He's like, man, this is a great album, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, actually, I'm kind of more excited to be getting Phil Collins' Face Value. And he gives me this look of like, you idiot.
How dare you?
You know nothing about music. How dare you?
Get out of my store.
It's like, and I'm just like, okay. You know, it's like, God forbid that I'd rather not listen to Yoko screeching and listen to Phil Collins sing In the Air Tonight.
God forbid that I give you money for music.
God forbid that I like a little bit of pop rock with some cool vocals and some awesome drum fills. All right.
Vintage Vinyl, thank you for what you do for St. Louis. Really appreciate you.
I do appreciate you, Vintage Vinyl. But that dude totally album shamed me.
How dare you?
How dare you album shame me?
How dare you carry this album in your inventory of your store, sell it to me, and make me feel bad about it?
Do you know what? It's like, you could have just accepted my money, but no. Like, that dude had to be just like, well, I'm the superior music aficionado because you obviously don't know the greatness of Double Fantasy over Face Value. Like, come on, dude. It's like, people say, like what they like.
Do you
just
know
shut
who
up.
I am? I host a podcast, sir.
This was years before the podcast.
I will one day host a podcast,
and
sir.
I am going to roast you so hard.
Yeah, got nothing against Vintage Vinyl, but I'm just pointing out that I haven't seen that dude since. But then again, I don't get to Vintage Vinyl as often as I would like. But
maybe he album shamed the wrong person.
Yeah. They didn't lose my business, I'm just saying. It's just that dude really kind of was annoying. So
sometimes you accidentally hire a turd.
Yeah.
A music snob.
It's funny,
somehow.
I hope to God that dude listens to our podcast one day and he hears this and he's just like, was that me?
Did I do that?
Am I a bad human being? And then he turns his life around.
It was about you.
The guy tried to tell you what was good music and bad music. I bet he lost all his money in the stock market.
He invested in Napster.
So there you go. That's my weird Double Fantasy album story. I still have the album. It is still in my collection. But I've definitely listened to Face Value way more times than I've listened to Double Fantasy. So.
It works for me.
So there you go. Moving on, jumping up to 2001, Beatles guitarist George Harrison died in Los Angeles of lung cancer at the age of 58.
Mm-hmm. I remember being so devastated. I was in high school, and I remember being so just devastated.
I think the big thing I remember, because I was pretty young then, and Rolling Stone had George Harrison's face on the cover,
mm-hmm,
right after his death. And I
that
think
really
that,
great photo of him.
That
yeah
was the most iconic moment of that for me. And I honestly, most of the Beatles history was before my time. I wasn't mm-hmm alive. So that was like the most iconic, like, wow, this is the Beatles here and now, was the passing of George Harrison.
And this once again brings us back to, if you have not seen A Concert for George, you are missing out. It is brilliant.
I will have to check that out. I'm a member of Amazon Prime, so I can get it in a couple of days.
Yes, you should.
I will. Like,
you need to get it. It's well worth the purchase to own that one. So
a little bit of the backstory on Mr. Harrison.
So, following the breakup of the Beatles, Harrison, of course, had a very successful career as a solo artist and later a part of the Traveling Wilburys. He was actually the youngest member of the Beatles. When he joined at the age of 16. Do you know who the oldest Beatle is?
The oldest Beatle?
Yeah.
I'm guessing Ringo.
It is Ringo.
Oh. I feel like it's Ringo.
Well, I'm glad you said it something first.
He likes trains.
Yeah. So he of course, had a bunch of great songs, you know, including Taxman, Here Comes the Sun, Something, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and, of course, My Sweet Lord, as we mentioned before. Harrison went on to release All Things Must Pass in 1970, a couple days before this, and which became, of course, a massive hit worldwide. So,
and Brian Croc, I think I feel like you know the answer to this, because we do know that Linda Harrison is not Linda Harrison, that was George Harrison's wife.
Linda McCartney's wife, Linda as well.
Well, what I'm talking about George Harrison's sister.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Anyways.
George Harrison's sister.
But where is it? Is she in Staunton or Livingston? Or she
She's nearby.
She lives very close to here. And I feel like... I mean, I feel like
we touched on this in a previous episode.
Yeah. Well, the thing is because she came in, I've met her before, and she did an interview, and I was trying to recall, and I'm sure you can pull it up, but it was like either Staunton
Louise Harrison...
Louise.
Yes. She actually left the Midwest and originally, I believe, lived in Benton, Illinois.
Benton, Illinois. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. She had moved around like a lot, apparently. And then like she moved to Canada, lived in Peru, and then finally lived in Benton, Illinois, where they landed in September 1963.
Wow.
How are you going to move from Peru to Benton, Illinois?
Well, obviously, there's got to be a particular reason there.
And so, George, long story short, was that George Harrison has been and stayed in Benton, Illinois quite a bit. And so there were actually sightings of George Harrison in the area here. You know, and I think I recall her saying that there was a house that the Beatles stayed in when they were, like, in town here. And so, like, there's actually a town that... Or not a town, a house that the Beatles stayed the night in, like right here in central Illinois, maybe 30 minutes from where we are now.
It says that she left Liverpool when he was 12, and then she didn't see him for a good while afterwards, though. So,
well, she was living in America, right?
Yes, yes. So, yeah. It's just really kind of crazy.
But, and Peru.
apparently she left in, she moved in like 2015.
Well, I didn't mean to sidetrack us too much, but I did know that there was kind of that connection here. So
yeah, there is like that weird sort of Southern Illinois connection to the Beatles.
Yeah. Well, because she did. I mean, when I was in Springfield, she came in person and was like, oh yeah, it's just a short little drive to come up and visit you. And she brought... She had headshots because she, you know, being the sister of George Harrison, her life is basically that she is the sister of George Harrison when she goes out in public. And so everything was always my brother this and my brother that. But I remember she brought in her favorite headshot. And it wasn't like a headshot like you'd see on from any of the publications or stuff, but it was just... She said, this is my favorite picture of my brother. And she would always sign that and hand it out. And I thought it was so adorable, so... We love you, George Harrison, and we love your sister just as much.
Yeah, she has always sort of been a lovely connection here in St. Louis.
And she's
people
always,
talk about her, so.
Yeah, and she's sweet, and she's an advocate. You know, like, she's still out being, like, promoting him and his music. And she's definitely, you could tell, was his biggest fan, so it's really cute. Well, you guys ready to move on to our final day?
I think we are.
Mm-hmm. November 30th. This day in history, on 1929, born none other than Dick Clark.
Yay! I loved him.
Dick Clark.
Dick Clark.
I absolutely loved Dick Clark. Some of my favorite childhood memories are watching the New Year's Rockin' Eve with him on it. Like, no matter how old he got, and he hung in there as long as he could, and I just loved it.
Well, that's right. Well, Dick Clark.
He's so cute.
Host of the U.S. TV's longest-running music show, American Bandstand. Mm-hmm. He created and produced the annual American Music Awards show, and he passed away on April 18th, 2012.
That's another one I got really sad about.
A good long life for Dick Clark there, though.
He did. He had a very good career, because, I mean, American Bandstand was on back in the 50s, so he'd been doing TV for, I mean, that was a great career.
Well, just think in 2010, you know, and you have Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve still going.
Yeah.
That's
I believe it's still called New Year's Rockin' Eve, Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve, when they do the event every year in Times Square. I believe Ryan Seacrest hosted it for a while. I'm not sure who's doing it now, but last time I checked, they're still doing it, and it's still called Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve, which I think is great way to honor him, because that's such a big thing for a lot of people. It's one of their holiday you know, last holiday things you do before the year starts is you sit down with your family, you watch the ball drop with Dick Clark on TV,
yeah,
you know?
It's a very notable, like, when you think of New Year's, Dick Clark's name does come to your mind.
Absolutely.
In one way or another, yeah.
And I can't tell you, you know, how many people grew up, adults now, you know, grew up watching American Bandstand and seeing people dance on TV for some of the first time and things like that. I thought that was so neat, learning about American Bandstand.
Well, here's a little fun fact. For those of you who don't know, Lady Scratch has a little bit of a soft side.
No, I don't.
No, she does not. No. No, I know you have a soft side because our next fact on this day in music history made her make that noise.
1969, November 30th. Menomina. If you're a Muppet fan or a human in general, I suppose you know this song. Jim Henson and Frank Oz perform Menomina on the Ed Sullivan Show, which is huge because Jim Henson had only been on the he'd been on the Ed Sullivan Show a couple of times. First time was just with his Kermit the Frog sock puppet. Like he's been on the Ed Sullivan Show multiple times. But Menomina just got so huge. They did it for the first season of Sesame Street, and you know, everybody can imagine the Muppet. I think his name's something like Bip Bip Boppity Boo or something. Like he's got some like scatty jazz name, you know, the little flaily haired pinkish orange fella flapping her ma-na-na-na, and the little female Muppets so that was filmed for Sesame Street's inaugural season in 1969 and then was performed by Jim Henson, Frank Oz, and I can't think of her name, but she played Susan on the show. But she performed the other Muppet character for that, the famous recording. And then they went and did it live on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then again did it for the first episode of The Muppet Show in, I believe, 76. So and then Cake covered it.
You're saying this is the first time it was performed ever?
Yeah, it was the first time it was performed live. It had been shown once or twice on Sesame Street. But they actually had live Muppeteers come in and do it on the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed Sullivan was a big Jim Henson fan, which I think is great. He liked Jim Henson and the Beatles. I feel like Ed Sullivan and I would have gotten along really well.
I know. I can't even imagine when like the Muppets and stuff first came around, just having that imaginative idea, you know, with the puppets and Jim Henson's just creative mind.
Before the Muppets even existed, actually, Jim Henson performed puppetry on the Ed Sullivan Show, and that was really his jumping off point was getting exposure from the Ed Sullivan Show with just this little Kermit the Frog green sock puppet that, you know, he'd made. And they did little commercials between the show for different sponsors. You know, the little sock puppet would come on and say, "For your worrisome woes, try blah, blah, blah tonic," you know, and that would be his commercials. So I just think that's really cool that Ed Sullivan was always so great about bringing on Jim Henson, and a lot of TV show hosts wouldn't have puppeteers on their show. That's just below their level of, you know.
Well, it's just like nowadays where, you know, somebody was like, cartoons are for kids. And now we have like a lot of adult cartoons.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like that. I get it.
I watch anime.
Yeah. See, there you go. That's cartoons for adults right there.
Yeah. Why not? Sure.
Well, before we move on, we can't move on without doing it. You ready?
One, two, three. Menomina. Menomina. Menomina.
Yay.
What a great song.
This is fun.
That was a blast. Good job, guys.
Menomina.
You know what else is fun?
Yes, I know. This one's a good one. So, Born.
Born.
No. Sorry. Wrong.
Not born.
Not born. No, this person was not born then. 1982. Michael Jackson's Thriller album was released.
Was born.
Dun, dun, dun. Cause this is Thriller.
So here,
let me give you some of the stats for this.
Yeah, I have questions.
Right. Okay, so the album was, of course, produced by Quincy Jones and cost $750,000 to make. Which was actually a massive undertaking back then. And it would go on to spend a full year in the top 10. So it went released November 30th, 52 weeks in the top 10, where it spent 37 weeks at number one. Wow. We talked about I Will Always Love You spending 14. It spent 37 weeks at number one. It was certified 33 times platinum, in the U.S.
Wow.
And worldwide, at the time, sold 66 million copies.
Huh? This is a dumb question.
Number one selling album of all time.
I wonder how much, like, 33 platinum records is worth, like, for scrap metal. Like,
that's a weird question.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, if someone went, like, 33 times gold, like, if it was real gold,
what would that sell for on the black market?
Like, how much money did they really make there just from the actual gold?
I mean, like, if you actually had a platinum album, like a full-on platinum album, you'd have to try and figure out how much that would actually weigh. So you'd have to guess, like, the surface area of an album, then the density of platinum, and then multiply that times 33.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it just the weight in ounces or something?
Miss Lady Scratch is giving me a weird look.
Well, I told you it was a dumb question. I'm just saying, if someone went 33 times
platinum.
See,
this is weird. You can't say stuff like that around me because then my brain wants to find the answer out.
Well, we had that same problem with, we did it with satellite radio.
Yes.
And what's the other thing we did it the other day that we spent way too much time?
I don't remember.
You guys spent way too much time on a topic? Ooh, now I'm getting looks.
How dare you? How dare you make fun of us and our weird goofiness?
Hey,
my
job's to ask the weird, unusual questions that nobody wanted.
You gave me an open invitation,
Yeah, it is true. But Greg was just like, you know, hey, Bree's coming on. Yeah!
I'm here to try and fill the shoes of the great Jacob Crumb. I'm only doing my best.
I'm just here to ask the questions.
He doesn't have huge,
like,
feet, though, so.
Like, what weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of bricks? That's
my question was a little more relevant. Just slightly.
Yes.
When did MTV start? 85? 84? I want to say 84.
Because we discussed this on the show. I remember that.
I just feel like I remember seeing Thriller, the
August
video.
August 1st, 81.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember seeing Thriller, the video. My mom said the first time
and
I watched it,
and that's actually kind of
the
funny thing is that, like,
screen.
You know, because when MTV first started, they didn't really have a lot of black artists on the air. And so when Thriller came out, like, they were a little bit hesitant to play it. But when everyone was demanding that they play videos from it, and it basically, like, every hour they had to play Thriller in its entirety because that's what people wanted.
It was one of the best videos to come out so early in the scene of music videos. It was just so well choreographed,
yes,
and put together. It was a short film for the time, you know?
Yes. So here, let me actually look up the track listing for Thriller because it's kind of like a fun.
It's got so much more on it than Thriller.
Yes, yes. Thriller, the Michael Jackson album. Of course, he's laying down in that white jacket with the black shirt and the Jerry curl.
We have that album do we still have it in the window? We have a little window shelf that we put albums
All
in.
Right. So
Thriller was there for a minute.
Here's kind of the funny. So track listing. There's only 9 tracks on the entire album. Start out with Wanna Be Startin' Somethin', mm-hmm, which, of course, was a song that he wrote when somebody, like, wrote something negative about him in an article. And he was just like, you want to be starting something? Like,
oh,
that was his response to it. Baby Be Mine. The Girl Is Mine, which he did with Paul McCartney.
Not Everything's Yours, okay.
Yes. Then Thriller at the end of side one, which makes sense because Thriller was almost 6 minutes long on the album. Then flip it over, Beat It, which is an anti-gang violence song.
About fighting?
Yeah. Billie Jean, you know, Human Nature, Pretty Young Thing, and The Lady in My Life.
What a great album.
It's a really great album. We need to review that.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We should totally plan ahead for when we're going to do that one.
So I'm glad this is recorded. He just invited me.
Yeah.
Did anyone else hear that? I got invited.
You know you've got a standing invitation for any time you want to come on. That's perfectly fine with me. So just like I've got standing invites for if my wife ever decides to come on, I have invited her on at least like 30 times. And she's just like, no, I don't want to get up and talk like to people. I'm like, that's fine. I'm just saying.
That's Brian's people.
She'll message me and just be like, you know, it's like, I'm bored. How about you come do the show with me? No.
Boy, I've heard this song before.
Lady Scratch is my PYT.
Oh, geez. Oh,
no.
Goodness.
I'm pretty, like, young thing.
Blushy on the radio.
No.
Good thing you can't see me.
So. Well,
let's completely.
But yes, I Okay, so Thriller, the album, is honestly, it is one of these penultimate moments in music history.
Like juggernaut.
It is a defining thing.
Good word, Greg.
What do you say?
Juggernaut.
Oh, juggernaut. See, I always associate juggernaut with X-Men, so that's, you can't do that with me. So it's one of these albums that, like, completely changed the music industry into something generally even better. Like,
it's a national treasure.
It is a national treasure. And honestly, I don't know if it's even possible for another album to sell this much.
No. I don't believe that in my lifetime I will ever see another album that surpasses Thriller.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things. We talk about groups like the Beatles, or we talk about, you know, Elvis, or like, you know, some of these other like super massive bands. I honestly, to me, Michael Jackson was the last like super rock star.
Yeah. And ever since Al Gore invented the internet, it's really been hard for anything to come back as much of a fan base as things like the Beatles and and Michael Jackson. You know, we weren't able to hear his music unless you either went somewhere and bought it, or you went to see them live.
Yeah.
Like, and then social media and has that, given us more opportunity to see shows, but I don't feel like we're going out as much.
One of the facts that I didn't put on here was that it was, like, I think it was 2016 or something, they announced that Drake was, like, the most streamed artist on the internet.
See?
Or something like that. And I'm just like, that doesn't count. That's like saying that's the most listened to person on the radio. It's like...
Right, but,
it's
yeah.
Like, it amazed me because I saw these, like, certain bands who released albums and stuff like that, and they talk, oh, this band is number one on the charts right now, despite the fact that album sales for, like, I'm trying to think of the name of the band, I don't remember right now, but they released it and had, like, you know, like 100-something thousand record sales in their week, but they weren't on the charts because they included YouTube plays and streams and like all that kind of stuff. And they're just like, well, they got, you know, 40 million streams this week.
Yeah. See, it's difficult for people to get to that fandom level. I mean, even in,
it's like, I think 1,000 streams, like, maybe should count as one album sale. I'm sorry. But that's really what it should be.
First of all, if you listen, there's an excellent playlist on Spotify called the Black Power Mixtapes.
Okay.
If you listen to that, you will find how many times people have sampled music from 1968 to 1972 that was written by artists of color. That being said, I cannot tell you how many tracks on that playlist I listened to and I was like, oh, that's where he got the sample for Hotline Bling, and oh, that's where he got the sample for, you know, and it was kind of mind-boggling to me. And it made me think about things like this, where these artists, the only way you could hear them was if you made an effort to, and now all you got to do is go to your computer and click on the YouTube, and there's Drake using that person's song to get all of these streams and all of this notoriety, and
yeah,
the internet. I'm old and shaking my fist.
Totally agree that it's become a completely different game, and we will never, I honestly believe we will never have another album like Thriller, because there is nobody out there who is popular enough to actually sell that many albums.
Because we especially have a totally different age. We're
totally different age.
It's just nothing comparable.
Totally different music industry economy. Completely different now. So there's nothing we can do about it.
Speaking of someone there will never be another one of.
Oh, we could say that about just about everybody on our list. But you
go
are right.
It.
In the year 1994... And this day in history, this was a big turning point for the career of none other than Tupac, a.k.a. Tupac Shakur, when he was shot 5 times during a robbery outside a New York City recording studio and officially launched Tupac and Biggie's beef, in a sense. Because Tupac, of course, was coming to try and, you know, do something with Notorious B.I.G. That's why Tupac was in New York City. And this was kind of like, oh, West Coast, East Coast getting together, showing some love.
Right.
Until, of course, the guy gets robbed and shot 5 times outside the recording studio. Tupac, of course, thought he was set up by, you know, Biggie's people. And it wasn't long after that that this kind of led to his eventual death.
Well, see, and I was
Vegas.
I was thinking Tupac got there and a robbery occurred. Like, Tupac was on his way to the studio and a robbery occurred, and Biggie thought Tupac's people were behind it. Am I backwards?
Tupac got shot.
I realized he got shot. I'm here. I was alive.
Like, he was going to the recording studio and he got attacked and he thought that he was set up.
How could he think that? He was dead. He got shot. That's what I'm saying. Like, I thought that Biggie's people
No, he wasn't dead. He wasn't dead.
He just got shot five times at this time.
Oh, this wasn't when he died.
No, he died in Vegas.
Oh,
no,
I'm saying this
started all the beef that eventually led.
Also, Tupac didn't, like, die immediately either.
Well, no, but I'm thinking of a different story then, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is in New York City at when Biggie had him swing by to record something.
Yeah.
And they were finally, like, you know, building the bridge between the coasts and stuff.
I'm merging the two stories together is what I'm
saying.
Yeah,
yep. Well, because Tupac got shot more than once is the moral of the story. And so this is the other time.
Which is also then when it weirdly became like a badge of honor for rappers to have been shot.
I remember there was a line.
I mean, if you get shot, where do you go from there?
Now,
brag about it,
now
right?
It's just other rappers who are just like, man, I got to get myself shot.
Or catch a body, one or the other.
There was a line in Changes that he did, which I thought was recorded before 94, but maybe it was came out in 95. But he one of the lines was something like getting popped six times or something, and then he got shot six times, or five times rather. But like he had somehow, what's the word I'm looking for? He just
predicted?
Yes, thank you. Having a hard time.
That's fine. I
words
forget words
to mouth.
Too.
What? How? Who?
But there's a line in Changes where he talks about getting shot, and then he got shot. Like, it's a very specific, like, number of times that he got shot, and then he got shot that number of times.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, Tupac is notorious for having songs predicting his death.
Prophetic, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah,
prophecy.
Yes.
Oh,
and you know, it's a shame that we're still talking about those issues this many years later that he's singing about. But that's a whole other...
I mean,
that's a whole other podcast.
That's the same old song and dance, as they say.
All right, let's move on to our final day, December 1st.
You know what's never the same old song and dance? Anything done by Bette Midler. I love Bette Midler. December 1st, 1944, Bette Midler was born. She was wonderful. She's wonderful. She's always been wonderful. She had a number one hit in 1989 with Wind Beneath My Wings.
Yes.
She's also done a number of wonderful musicals and theater and... I mean, a lot of people my age probably know her from Hocus Pocus, and that's probably as far as it goes.
Yeah. But very big in movies, in music, in Broadway.
Mm-hmm. She's done it all.
Does she have an EGOT?
Oh, I don't know. She may have an Oscar for what's that movie that she did? The Wind Beneath My Wings was the movie, I believe. She's not an EGOT winner because I don't think there are any female EGOT winners.
I'm looking it up right now.
I don't think that's true. I'm pretty sure there are several.
Are there?
Or at least there's at least one. We've looked up the EGOT list before on the show.
Yeah, I know. We look up the EGOT list all the time.
We're always looking stuff
up. But I feel like every time we look up the EGOT list, I'm always surprised by who's not on there. So I guess that's where I'm presuming, maybe unjustly. But yeah, gosh, Bette Midler, she's wonderful in that she can just be herself. Because when she came out as an artist, like when she first came on the scene, she was just kind of pegged as the Jewish girl. And she would do things like Fiddler on the Roof and all that. But she came out and she blew everybody's minds, and she's wonderful. And I'm a big fan of Bette Midler and everything that she's done with her theater work. I think she's underrated to these kids today. I don't think they get her.
Yeah, she needs to work with Kanye.
Maybe then people will know who she is.
This new up-and-comer, Bette Midler. Ladies and gentlemen, put your smartphones together for Bette Midler.
All right, so Bette Midler has won 3 Grammys,
mm-hmm.
3 Emmys, and 1 Tony.
Oh, see, I thought she had an Oscar for a movie. And I
nope, she has not won an Oscar.
But she's doing well.
But
she should win an Oscar.
Here's the cool thing about this list is that because it takes, you know, generally a longer period of time, she can still win it.
Oh, sure.
It's still entirely possible.
Yeah. She's not going anywhere anytime soon.
So Great. She's you just spicy. Cursed her now. She's going
to. No, I didn't.
Great.
That I love you.
I've got a bad power for this because this happens to me a lot where all of a sudden somebody comes up and then it's like, boom, they die.
Yeah. Next week's episode, we're going to have to announce her death or something.
Fats Domino. We were talking about Fats Domino, and I was like, it's amazing that he's still alive. Died the next day.
I'm not amazed that Bette Midler's still alive. I think she's still quite the kicking
rod. What's her name?
She's got things
like,
going.
Who did the song Stand By Your Man? I was like, wow,
Tammy
that's
Wynette.
Tammy Wynette.
She was old, though.
And it's like, boom, died.
Bette Midler's not old.
I am not kidding. I have a weird thing.
1944
that, like,
isn't old.
I can all of a sudden, somebody pops into my head, and I was like, oh, yeah, that artist. Wow, that's amazing. And then, like, within a week, they're dead.
If you subconsciously kill Bette Midler, I'm going to be really
mad at
you.
If Bette Midler dies in the next week, then it's just I don't have control over that. I didn't do it. I'm just saying. It's weird.
I just had a
weird mojo that happens with me.
Can you hear me?
You want to talk about prophetic? I'm just saying.
If, like, you do this, I'm going to be really mad at you.
If she dies in the next week, then, like, everyone will know that I'm the weird oracle of celebrity deaths.
You are to blame.
Then again, I didn't get anything for, like, Prince or David Bowie or any of those, so. But I don't know. It only happens randomly. So there you go.
I'm really mad if you kill Bette Midler.
Bette Midler, please
prophecies.
Stay alive so Bree can be happy and not mad at me. So
I think that's a good plan for
Let's
everyone.
Let's go ahead and jump up many, many decades to somebody that I actually really respect. 1988, born on this day, Tyler Joseph. Now, most of you probably have no idea who Tyler Joseph is. That's perfectly fine. I can understand that. Tyler Joseph is one half of the band 21 Pilots.
Is he the 21 or is he the pilot?
See, and that's kind of funny because he actually got the name from an Arthur Miller play.
Mm. It's true.
Because one of the characters in there, like, sold bad parts to the military during World War II, and it resulted in the death of 21 pilots. And so Tyler Joseph always thought that it was a fascinating thing with the story because it's like, he did what he did to help his family, to save his business so his family could continue living. But at the same time, his actions caused the death of 21 other people. And so it's like, how do you balance that? Like, if he'd given them the proper parts, his family would have been wouldn't have been well off or anything. Probably would have been homeless and all that. But because he saved his family, he killed other people. And it's like a weird dichotomy. It was a fascinating play. If you haven't had a chance to see the play that it's based on, it's called All My Sons, I think. It really, really good play. They recently did it at Webster University this last year, and I had a chance to see it. It was really good. But Arthur Miller is a fantastic playwright. So, Tyler Joseph, one half of 21 Pilots. He is generally the vocal and other instrument half. The other member is Josh Dunn, who is a drummer. And that's really what he does. So Tyler Joseph is the one who puts the songs together. He writes the lyrics. He develops the instrumentation and, like, sort of the entire, like, artistic direction of the group. And Josh Dunn records drum parts for the band. And then he is a major part of when they're actually playing on stage because he's a force on the drums. He's really, really good. But even more so than that, he's really, really entertaining to watch. Like, he's just one of those types of dudes. So I, of course, am a big fan of 21 Pilots. I have been for a while. I didn't get them at first. I had listened to, like, one of their songs and was like, okay, whatever. This I don't really care for this.
Yeah.
And then I started listening to it more in depth, and I've never come across a group quite like them that can sort of bend between genres and talk about things that most people don't normally talk about, i.e. like mental health issues, depression, you know, just dealing with the world and trying to figure out your place in it. Like, a lot of artists, generally, when they do that kind of a thing, it's just really depressing.
It's like Radiohead.
Yeah. Like, you know, Radiohead is a prime example of that. It's like, but when Tyler Joseph does it, it's a little bit more like, you know, look, you can deal with this. It's possible to really get through this. You just, you know, you need to do whatever it is. You know, it's like, I've always liked the line that he has in one of his songs where he says, sometimes to stay alive, you got to kill your mind.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that that was a fascinating idea of, you know, sometimes you just got to say, shut up. I'm not going to listen to my head today. Like, it's destroying everything else.
Yeah. I like that he's not afraid to also... I like him because he's not afraid to say it like it is.
Yeah.
But like even in one of their songs where they talk about, it's one of their more popular songs and I can't think of the name because brains today.
If you tell me a line, I can probably tell you.
But it's the one where he's talking about the record industry and he's like, I feel like every song is common and I want to do a song with different time signatures and time changes, but they want a pop song. So
it's stressed out. That's the name.
Yeah. That was one of the lines that stuck out to me so much is that he was just like, every song is so common and I have all this inside me and I just want to get it out, but that's not what they want from me.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of songs about the record industry that are like that, but I just like how his syncopation and the way that he explains things. And like,
and he even did that in another song where he said, you know, or it's that song where he says, you know, this song will never be played on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, which is funny because then that song ended up being played on the radio.
That was on the radio.
But even other stuff too, like in some of the other songs, you know,
Don't trust a song that's flawless. That's one of my favorite lines.
Yeah. He's got a ton of just really, really good lines that he's written. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they're going to do next because they're on a break right now after doing the tour for 2 years. Tour de Columbus is what they actually called it. When they finished up their tour, they went back to Columbus, Ohio, where they're from. And Tyler Joseph still lives there. He bought a house like down the street from his parents after he got married. And they played like a big show, like they played like basically in all the clubs that they had played at, like getting to where they are now.
Oh, that's cool.
And so they did like the big arena, then they did like the mid-size, like pageant size, and then they did like the tiny club, and then they even did some like home shows.
A couple dive bars in Columbus or something.
Yeah,
that's
and
really
so
cool.
But I've always liked it because, well, one, Tyler Joseph it appears to be an extremely intelligent songwriter, which is
certainly
super cool to see.
His use of metaphor is wonderful.
Yes, yes. And then on top of that, he is a man of faith, which is something that I also connect to.
I didn't realize that.
He's a devout Christian, actually.
Hmm.
And there you can find the first like real album that I think he made was actually like a Christian album. And it's just Tyler Joseph. So it's not 21 Pilots. And the other like two original members of 21 Pilots were also like people that he went to church with and stuff. And then Josh Dunn like came along later. But actually, if you see, now that you know that information, though, go back and listen to some of the songs on Vessel and you'll make those connections. You'll be like, OK, so this is what he means by that. This is what he's referencing sort of in this kind of a statement. But one of my favorite ones that he had with a song was when he said he was basically talking about people making fun of people of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, you know, and he finishes out the line with saying, so excuse us while we sing to the sky. It's like, and it's basically a reference to that saying, mm-hmm. like, you know what? It's like, look, not all of us can deal with the world in the way that like other people deal with it. So we need this other thing. We need this faith. We need this belief in God, you know, so just shut up and let us sing to the sky.
That's really interesting because I really appreciate when bands get popular and the press doesn't zero in on the fact that they're people of faith. You know, there's so many bands that have come out where it's like, yeah, but did you know they were once a Christian band? And then they just get pigeonholed. You know, they're that Christian band. You know, I mean, freaking Jonas Brothers and the Promise Rings. It's a huge thing that was unnecessary.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with the music or the bands, the artists themselves.
So the funny thing for me is that with 21 Pilots is that I jokingly call them the best Christian band out there right now. Because
they're a band and they're Christians.
They're a band and they're Christian, but they aren't a Christian band.
Right.
It's like, even though Tyler's faith plays a big part in his music and like that kind of stuff, it's like he never bashes you over the head with it.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably why
and
people haven't picked up on it. That's probably why the press hasn't
I've been on fan groups for 21 Pilots, and somebody posted an article about, you know, it's like Tyler Joseph's faith, in God and how it affects his writing, like, and stuff, like, just little articles like that. And the people are just like, I had no idea.
Yeah.
It's like, that's kind of the point.
The media hasn't made a big deal about it, which is fantastic because I feel like that ends up, you know, like I said, pigeonholing and people can't get out of that that little narrow space of like, oh, well, they're Christian artists, because it just drops so many people off of even wanting to listen when they should be, whether they're people of faith or not. Like, listen to the music of this person, whether they're a person of faith or not. I tangent about that. Sorry.
So either way, December 1st, happy birthday to Tyler Joseph. You, you're a cool dude, and I'd like to hang out with you one day.
The only thing I have to say,
moving on,
about 21 Pilots is that they're probably the most relatable band for me personally out there right now, because they're the same age as me and they're singing about stuff that people like me deal with. So good,
connecting with the world, trying to function.
A friend in us.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the year is 1990, and a 4-week run at number one kicks off with this single, "Ice Ice Baby." It's Vanilla Ice. Doom 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 doom.
You supposed to like actually plan that out. You supposed to plan that for December 1st. It's like it's winter, ice. You know, makes sense.
Get it?
Ice, ice, baby.
I get it. I love his interview.
Stop.
His interview about...
Collaborate and listen.
Oh,
ice is back
song.
With a brand new invention.
You want to start
something
it?
Grabs a hold of me tightly, flow like a hawk through daily and nightly. Will it ever stop?
I don't know.
Turn off the lights.
No, I'm not going
And
on.
I glow.
I'm not going on
I'm
with
trying
it.
To the extreme, I'm trying to talk about an interview.
Light up, light up a stage and wax a chump like
I'm
a candle.
I'm trying to be like Jacob and bring professionalism to this outfit. Now hang on.
So anyways, you may recognize Ice Ice Baby's very familiar, very stolen bass line.
It wasn't stolen.
Theirs goes like this, and mine goes like this.
Yeah, you might recognize the famous case of it being compared to Queen and David Bowie's number one hit single, Under Pressure.
It's completely different.
Ice Ice Baby was initially released as the B-side to the rapper's cover of Play That Funky Music. Became the A-side after US DJs grabbed onto it and played it.
So here's kind of the funny thing about Vanilla Ice is that he went on this really weird arc, like superstardom, awesome. And then it's like everything he produced after was complete and total crap.
Mm-hmm.
And then he crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just like, screw Vanilla Ice. It's like, I'm not him anymore. I'm going off and doing something else. And then now, like, the weird resurgence of... like
90s nostalgia.
Like he's come back up again.
Guess who's back?
And he's like able to go out and play shows as Vanilla Ice.
Doesn't he have it?
And I was just like, man, why can't he like rock that hairstyle again?
Bring the flat top back. Come on with the kid and play. Let's see it.
Do that really puffy, you know, jacket.
Didn't he have a home improvement show for some time?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Vanilla Ice's Flip This House, or was it to have like his real name?
I don't recall
his real name now. He did like he
white people flipping houses.
That's HGTV.
No, he had like a home improvement show for a while there, which was really kind of fascinating. He's had a weird life, you know, going up and down all over the place. But
he played the Decatur Celebration.
Yes.
Well, we talked about 2 weeks ago as well. Vanilla Ice was the first rapper ever to hit number one.
That is true.
Is that true?
Ever.
Yep.
First rapper ever.
No.
First rapper to hit number one on the Hot 100 or Hot 200 or whatever.
Yeah. On the Billboard Hot 100.
Hot 100. That's right. Yeah.
I wish my face could translate to radio.
Yeah. She's given a pretty.
That's such a sad
face.
Day for hip hop.
It's sad when it's. I mean, it is what it is, but it's sad if you sit down and you say, here's the history of hip hop.
I would not bring up Vanilla Ice in the history of hip hop unless I had to, and now I have to.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that, you know, if you took like, oh, here's the history of hip hop and this momentous occasion when Vanilla Ice became the first rapper.
That makes me
to
mad.
Hit number one.
That makes me almost as mad as I am at Drake.
Well, you should have been here 2 weeks ago.
All right, Bree.
Oh, yeah.
Close out.
I'm closing this out. This is
close
great.
Close out the final.
I remember when this happened.
Fact.
I watched part of it live.
This is going to be record breaking.
December 1st, 1997, Kenny G set a new world record when he held a note on his soprano saxophone for 45 minutes and 47 seconds.
Just a brief clip of it would sound something like.
Not the best. best soprano saxophone impression I've heard, but very close.
Well,
good job, Greg.
Imagine that for another 45 minutes.
Then 40, yeah. Yeah. The record has since been broken by Giovanni Escalante, who held a note for 1 hour, 30 minutes, and 45 seconds, using the technique that Kenny G also used called circular breathing. It is a very difficult technique to learn. I can't do it, but basically it you breathe in through your nose whilst breathing out of your mouth.
Yeah. So what it is you puff up your cheeks and you learn how to control it to where you can breathe out with your cheeks while inhaling through your nose.
I think the concept would be put that you're breathing in through your nose while you're pushing. So you're not.
It's all about cheek control.
Yeah. You're not blowing out when you're breathing in. You are simply pushing the
Why
air out of your mouth.
This?
I don't know.
This is fantastic.
Because we don't have cameras here, so we'd have to do it in my other office if we wanted to have cameras here.
We look like cute little chipmunks trying to control our cheeks.
But, yeah.
Anyway, yes, so that, I don't know if anybody, I don't remember what it was on.
I remember
that. But I remember watching it.
Let's see. Where did it take place, actually?
That's what I'm wondering. Like, I don't remember where it aired or where it took place, but I just remember that it was a very significant event for America.
I remember seeing some, like, highlight reel. You know, it was something like, I love the 90s.
Yeah, and there's this classic clip of him, and he's just standing there, and his eyes are kind of wide open, like, oh, can you believe I'm still doing this? Me too, guys.
That was kind of the joke I was trying to make, was that he's breaking a world record, but for 45 minutes, he's holding a single note.
Even he's annoyed at himself, and you could tell in the clip, he's just like, I can't believe I'm still doing this either, but here we are.
See, for some reason, I weirdly remember somebody breaking a record for holding the longest note at the CN Tower in Toronto. But I don't remember what it was. I think it was actually somebody singing a note. And what it was is they needed the wind so they could, like, basically blow air into their nose while, like, it was really kind of weird. I want to say it was singing, but it wasn't a saxophone. I know that much. So
I know that there was a competition for a world's longest note being held, and I do recall the person trying to use some kind of circular breathing but unable to do so while singing, which makes sense. So I guess that's how you would have to do it. You'd have to use a biological climate controlled environment to do that, but poor Kenny G's record got broken by Giovanni Escalante.
I mean, it was well broken, too. It was like twice as long.
But I feel like it's one of those things where Kenny G was like, I'm going to set the record because I'm Kenny G and I am Kenny G. I can play the soprano saxophone and I know how to circular breathe. And so people were just like, you should do it, Kenny G. And then this guy was like, yeah, but look how long I can go. And Kenny didn't care as much. Like, once he broke the record, I think he, like, stopped shortly after, if I recall correctly.
Okay, so I think the keynote here, too, is that Kenny G is not remembered for this record.
Yeah.
No, that, it's
well,
not.
That's true. I actually just looked it up, but the, so it was somebody else doing something who did it at the CN Tower. The longest vocal note ever held is actually 1 minute and 52 seconds.
That's a long time.
And it had to be heard, above a decibel threshold from a measurement of 2.5 meters, which means it had to be heard 2.5 meters away.
Okay.
So it didn't have to be loud.
Well, loud enough that you're going to use your diaphragm anyway. You're going to use a lot of core muscles when trying to do that. But I can't imagine like having to maintain.
I can hold a note for about a minute.
The same note?
Yeah.
That's the thing is like, how do you,
I've just
like,
got
I would
exceptional
get
lung capacity. So
I've got a strong diaphragm so I can hold notes for a long time as well. But like if it's a certain pitch or certain note, I just start to waffle out at the end. And I feel like what most people do. They just start to lose it at the end.
No, I mean, I can.
Or you can tell you're about to lose it. So you stop. But I definitely couldn't.
No, trust me. I can hold a note like the same note for a very long time.
Can you hold it for 45 minutes and 47 seconds?
No, because that requires a completely different technique. But it's kind of weird that my first thought when I think of like a 1 minute and 52 seconds is like, I could probably train myself to beat that.
You could do anything for 10 seconds and then 10 more. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're at 2 minutes and you win.
Exactly. So that has been This Week in Music History.
Yeah, what a
going
fun week.
From November 27th through December 1st. Once again, if you want to help out our show, you can go to our website and click on that Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Once again, Christmas stuff is coming up. You can buy all your presents on Amazon and it gets shipped right to you. And if you help us out, it's really simple and it won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money. It's perfect for us.
It really is easy.
And good for you.
If you type in followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon, it just redirects you straight to Amazon.
Straight to
you
Amazon.
You don't have to do anything extra.
Exactly. So there you go.
Thanks for the tip.
I have been your host, Brian Kroc, and Jake, of course, has still been out sick, as we mentioned earlier. We hope he gets better and will be back with us soon. But filling in for him has been Bree, DJ Lady Scratch. You were awesome.
Oh, thanks. I'm just trying to be here for Jake in his time of need.
And, of course, Greg Harvey.
I'd like to mention that Jake has longer hair than my client and has won some famous battles. And I think his hair was powdered because of fleas, and I have no fleas.
Menomina, remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.